Indeed, the structure of heavy quark QQ bar bound states, the quarkonia. Now probably it's time to start studying the structure of the proton. And in the structure of the proton, it turns out that there's one more important surprise that gives insight into the nature of the strong interactions. And so that's what I'd like to describe today. Now, how would you determine the quark structure of the proton? Well, one very interesting way is to try and look at the proton with electromagnetic probes, essentially using a high-energy accelerator as a kind of electron microscope. And this is something that was studied actually at Stanford way back in the 50s. Robert Hofstadter had access to a GeV energy linear accelerator for electrons. And so he studied electron-proton scattering. And he was mainly interested in electron-proton elastic scattering, with the idea that you could measure the form factor, F of Q squared here, so Q is this momentum transfer, and that this would tell you in the way that you do in when you use an electron microscope, the Fourier transform of this would somehow be the structure of the proton. And he was very surprised to find out that the proton form factor falls off rather rapidly. In fact, F of Q squared goes like 1 over Q squared squared for Q squared greater than about a GeV squared. So this is another indication, actually one of the earliest indications, that the proton is actually a big fluffy bag of stuff. And if you hit it hard enough, it's just disrupted, so you no longer get elastic scattering. What you get instead is, well, first of all, the proton will turn into some kind of nucleon resonance, and we've studied a few of those in the course, and as I said, there are lots more. You guys now, I guess, even understand the what's called the Reggie trajectory, the linear dependence of masses. And then eventually you start having processes that are just a proton or a neutron plus a large number of pions. Sorry? Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, I told you in the first lecture that nucleon resonances had the structure of a quark flying around two quarks bound by a relativistic string. And if you in the figures for the first lecture, the last figure was a regularity that says that these states obey m squared is equal to alpha prime times j. Sorry, the other way around. A linear relation between angular momentum and mass squared. And then you folks derived that that's a property of a relativistic string. So it all hangs together. Okay? So this model of the resonances produces this regularity. And so now we, and then this regularity is actually obeyed in experiment. And I showed you at least one. I just gave it a name. Don't worry about it. Yes?
Is it a different string to the string in string theory, though?
Well, yes, although people think there are mathematical relations between them. Actually, this is an open problem to derive the string from that. Okay. Okay, so very good. So, in this class, we're focused mainly on very high energy, with the idea that if we go to high energy, we'll probably have a more clear picture of the real underlying quark structure of these processes. We saw that that's true in electron-positron annihilation, that when you're at low energy, you see resonances, and when you're at high energy, you see pairs of quark jets obeying just the simple electrodynamics of electrons and quarks. So maybe it should be here true. It should be true here too. And what I'd like to do in this lecture is to convince you that it is. So what I'd like to do is to study electron-proton scattering in the very high energy limit, or more precisely, in the limit where the momentum transfer from the electron to the photon is extremely large. What I'd like to do is to make a rather simple, I think you would even say naive, model of how that scattering process occurs, derive the formulae for that model, and compare them to data, and we'll see how it works. Okay? So the regime, this regime here, where q squared is a very large number, and where you have many particles produced, is called a deep inelastic scattering. And that's the last of these kind of keystone experiments of the quark picture of particle physics. And so today I'd like to derive the formulae for this and tell you a little about the experimental data. Okay. So now I'd like to make the following very simple model of deep inelastic scattering. We said already the proton is a loosely bound structure containing three quarks and some number of gluons. The gluons are electrically neutral, but the quarks have electric charges, so the electrons should be able to scatter from the quarks by electromagnetic forces. So what I'd like to do is ignore the effect, of the binding of the proton, and just concentrate on the proton, the individual electron quark scatterings. We'll get some formula for the cross-section for electron quark scattering, and then we'll try and wrap that up somehow into a formula for electron proton scattering, and then we'll see how this works. So the first thing we need is a formula for the cross-section for the process electron quark goes to electron quark. And so once again, this will be similar. The derivation will be parallel to what you had in the tutorial. I think Callum has told you how to derive this cross-section, or at least the cross-section for E mu goes to E mu by very direct methods. So now I'm going to come and do it by a sneaky method. Now, the sneaky method actually has some lesson which is good to learn. So let's discuss this in some detail. So I'd like to consider the two-body, in general, the two-body process. So let me tell you first what the method is. So we've already studied the reaction. E plus E minus goes to QQ bar. And that's a reaction where an electron and a positron come in, a quark and an antiquark go out. The reaction we're interested in here is a reaction where an electron scatters from a quark. And if you look at these two diagrams, you see that they are identical. One is just rotated from the other one. Time is, for me, is always going this way. Is that okay? Yeah. Oh, okay. Anyway, if you're confused about which way time goes, you're probably in the right place. Okay. A couple days ago, I computed this diagram. Now we need to compute this diagram. The most important thing is to note that it's the same diagram. And this is more than just a kind of sleight of hand. These diagrams are related by having an antiquark here in the final state turn into, over here, a quark in the initial state. And it's clear there should be a relation between those things, because the same field operator that creates the antiquark destroys the quark. And similarly, over here, there's a positron in the initial state, and here there's an electron in the final state. So again, it's governed by the same field operator. So if we just compute the matrix element of this field operator, then we can interpret that matrix element by putting a different momentum through it, either as mediating, giving us the amplitude for this process or the amplitude for this process. So now what I'd like to do is to formalize that a little for the case of two-particle-to-two-particle scattering. So let's consider a general two-particle scattering amplitude, K1, K2, K3, and K4. So then it's very convenient to write the basic Lorentz invariant quantities associated with this amplitude. So those are called S So these two quantities are equal by momentum conservation. And this is also equal to the center of mass energy squared, which is why I've persisted in calling that quantity S already in the first couple lectures. And where there's S, there's probably two more quantities called T and U. So T is this one. Is equal to K4 minus K2 squared. And U is this one, which is equal to K4, K3 minus K2 squared. Okay? Just definitions, but these quantities are now Lorentz invariant quantities. ST and U obey a very pretty identity. If I just add up everything that's on the blackboard, I get 1, 2, 3 appearances of K1, 3 appearances of K2 squared, 3 appearances of K3 squared, and 3 appearances of K4 squared. If I add up everything on the blackboard, that's 2 appearances of S, 2 appearances of T, and 2 appearances of U. So there are 3 K1 squareds, 3 K2 squareds, 3 K3 squareds, etc. Then plus 2 times from here, K1.K2, from here, K3.K4, from here, minus K1.K3, etc. Okay? Now, let's gather this up together with one factor of that, and we can write that as K1 plus K2 minus K3 minus K4. Okay, so if I complete the square with this, I borrow some of those, I get this factor. And this is well known to be 0 by momentum conservation. And what's left over is twice the things that I have there. But these guys are just the masses of the external particles. So finally, we learn that S plus T plus U is equal to the sum of the masses of the external particles. And that's a very convenient equation to learn. Yes?
Wait, why is the momentum squared?
The K squared equals M squared. Yeah.
Right.
This is all 4 vectors.
Oh, okay.
4 vectors.
Okay. Sorry. We're talking about 3 vectors.
No. I'm sorry. Everything is 4 vectors. Okay. Just for some examples, if I have all the masses vanishing, then I would have something like K1 is E00K. So these are the vectors that we worked with a couple days ago. K3 is E sine theta 0 cosine theta. K4 would be E minus sine theta 0 minus cosine theta. And then you can just readily compute ST and U. S is 4e squared. T is minus 2e. And then if I dot this into this, you'll get 1 minus cosine theta. And U is minus 2e1 plus cosine theta. And if I add them all up, I get 0, which is good. Okay, so now now these are very convenient variables. And they're especially convenient when we talk about the relation between processes like this and like this that are related by displacing a particle from the final state to its antiparticle in the initial state. Yes? Yes. So when they're massless, this side is 0. And so these three expressions should add up to 0, and indeed they do. OK. And note that S is positive and T and U are negative. So if you just keep that in mind, we'll see what happens when we do this particle-antiparticle interchange. So formally, the business of moving a particle in the final state to its antiparticle in the initial state is called crossing. And Feynman diagrams are crossing symmetric in a sense that I would now like to explain to you. So you still look puzzled. What's the problem? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Sorry. These are all, Okay, well. Okay, the solution is clear. Have some caffeine. Now it's right. And the K should be E's. When the rest of my brain arrives, I'll do better. I'm sorry. Okay, let's see if that improves things. Okay, so now let's look at how, in terms of this notation, how Feynman diagrams deal with crossing. So an easy way is just to compare like half of the diagram. So I'm going to compare, for example, the current that we had for when we produce mu plus mu minus, for example. So if I take the matrix element squared, that's going to be something like the trace of k slash plus m gamma mu k bar slash minus m and gamma nu. And then that'll be dotted into some similar thing from the bottom half of the diagram. Now I'm going to compare that to the cross of this. So I'm going to take, for example, the Q bar here, and I'll put that in the initial state. And so now I'm comparing it to something like this with, continue to call this K here, and let's call this K twiddle here. So now the matrix element squared is involving some quantity that looks like this, K slash plus M, gamma mu, K tilde slash plus M, gamma nu. Okay, well, it's clear that these quantities are basically the same function. All I've done is that I replace K bar by minus K tilde, and then it turns out you also have to have a minus sign for each fermion. One of these Dirac minus signs, a minus sign for each fermion that you cross over. And then this expression becomes this mathematical expression. And so if you've worked out an amplitude in terms of the momenta here, you just replace k bar with minus k tilde. And now what happens is that this particle in the final state becomes the antiparticle in the initial state. And you use the same mathematical expression to compute the amplitude. Yes?
Follow the diagram.
OK, so once again, the fermion line is going like this, the momenta are going like that. Yes?
I don't understand where mu and nu go in
Yes.
Are you also taking equations for them?
Well, if I had the whole diagram, there would be another one of those things, and it would be dotted into it.
Okay.
Okay. So the full diagram would then have another trace, and that would have a mu and a nu in it. And the same thing would be true for that half of the diagram. Okay. Well, this is a pretty simple rule. Just, you've already calculated the diagram. You take the momenta in the final state, you change them to negative momenta, and those represent momenta in the initial state. But we can make the rule even simpler by thinking about ST and U. Because, let me get rid of this now. So let's think specifically about the processes we're interested in. We started out with E minus, E plus, Q, and Q bar, where this had momentum K1, K2, K3, and K4. Now we're interested in the process E minus, E minus, E plus, sorry, Q, and Q, where these have momenta K1, K2, K3, and K4. So if we've already calculated these amplitudes, we can obtain these directly by the substitution. K2 is going to minus K3, because this guy is becoming that guy in the final state. K3 going to K4, because I'm moving this guy over here, just for convenience. K4 is going to minus K2, because this guy in the final state is becoming this guy in the initial state. And from the definitions there, you can see that this is exactly S going to T, T going to U, and U going to S. So if I have a Lorentz invariant amplitude, it'll be a function of ST and U. And if I want to cross it, I just make these simple substitutions. Okay. Or you could calculate it the hard way, and you'll get the same answer. It's good to do both when you're learning. Yes?
So the trick then would be to find amplitude in terms of ST and U, and then perform that substitution?
Right. Okay. Or find it in terms of the momenta and perform this substitution. But generally, when you can do this, it's really easy. And this will happen naturally if you have a Lorentz invariant. Okay. Now, here I've applied crossing to spin-summed amplitudes, spin-summed squares of amplitudes. On Wednesday, I was working in terms of helicity amplitudes, that is, the amplitudes themselves. Helicity amplitudes don't generally have simple crossing rules, because helicity is, as I explained on Wednesday, an ill-defined quantity. It depends what frame you're in. You have to be just incredibly careful about that to do crossing with individual amplitudes. However, in the massless case, the helicity amplitudes are well-defined Lorentz invariant states. And in that case, it actually works. I won't prove it to you, but it can be shown that the crossing relations are extremely simple, and you can just cross individual massless helicity amplitudes. Essentially, it has to do with the fact that for a massless particle, the U's and V's for fermions obey the same equation. So you can use the same polarization vectors for U's and V's. OK, well, yes? Just for fermions. For bosons, that sign isn't there. If you cross two fermions, there's no minus sign. OK. Yes?
since we used that to drive the STU permutation there, for bosons, what would the permutation of STU be?
Oh, I'm sorry. All this is just the four vectors.
Right.
The momentum. These are the same.
But then where the I thought the minus sign was what gave us.
Oh, no. When we went from k bar minus m to k tilde plus m, I said turn k bar into k tilde, and then to minus k tilde, and then there's an extra minus sign in the amplitude. So,
so
if I go from here to here, I'll get minus k tilde minus m, which is equal to this up to a minus sign. And that minus sign is a Dirac minus sign. It's there for fermions. It's not there for bosons.
And that went away because we considered the square. So
if we square the amplitude, it goes. So actually, the minus sign, oddly, is in the square of the amplitude. So please excuse me. OK, there's a minus sign in the square of the amplitude in the derivation. So it's one of these minus signs that you have to know about when you work with a Dirac equation. But it's okay. Yes.
How can there be a minus sign in the middle of the square to the positive number?
Well, we computed an amplitude. We then go in and we substitute k to minus k in a lot of the momentum. Then minus signs can appear. Right?
Okay.
And the right answer is you multiply by some minus signs that get rid of them, and then you get the right answer on the other side. Okay. But what I'd like to do now is to do crossing on individual amplitudes, which, as I say, you're allowed to do if you have massless particles and you deal with those. Okay. So with that introduction, let's now do what I've suggested that we do. Namely, write down the amplitudes that we computed on Wednesday. So these are e plus e minus to q q bar amplitudes that I computed on Wednesday. I now recognize that these amplitudes can be easily written in terms of the st and u expressions for massless particles. This is minus 2ie times qf times u over s. Oh, let me remind you again, s is 4e squared. T is minus 2e squared, 1 minus cosine theta. And u is minus 2e, 1 plus cosine theta, because these expressions were written in the center of mass frame. Now, I recognize that that over that gives me this. And this one is 2ie squared qf times t over s. And then I look at what's over here on the blackboard. And then without any further calculation, we can write down the amplitudes for electron quark scattering. QF S over T. And for a right-handed quark, so this is when the helicities are the same. When the helicities are opposite, qf, you get u over t. The 1 over t in the denominator is really easy to understand, because this 1 over t is just 1 over q squared. And q is the momentum that transfers that way. And so it's just the singularity that comes from exchanging a photon, basically in the electromagnetic interaction between the electrons and quarks. Yes?
How come we only have to apply the crossing rules once if we're actually crossing two particles? Because there's the quark that moves to the initial state and the positron that moves to the final state.
Oh, I'm sorry, but that's what I have here. So this,
oh, I
this
thought
guy,
that was for a single.
No, no, it's for the whole process. So if you compare this and this, K2 goes to minus K3, K3 goes to K4, and K4 goes to minus K2.
Sorry, I misunderstood. Just got a little lost.
Okay, so this thing here makes the whole rearrangement that we want to make.
Yeah. Okay.
Then we get these very simple rules, and then we just apply those rules to the answers we had on Wednesday, and we have some new answers. Yes?
So I assume in the top two, matrix elements, you're supposed to have an E squared.
Yes. Okay. Good. Okay. And this crossing business is a very beautiful trick that we will see many times again in this course. And it's just incredibly useful. But this is certainly one of those places where it proves its use. Okay, well, now we can pretty much write down the answer. So now in the center of mass frame, d sigma d cosine theta for E left, Q left scattering is, now you remember this formula, 1 over 2s, 1 over 16 pi. The 16 pi combines with the e squared to become a pi alpha squared. And then the square, the rest of it is 4, the quark charge squared times u over s squared. And the other expression, the scattering of an E left from a Q right, okay. It should be this expression I'm using. The E left from a Q right is 1 over 2s pi alpha squared times 4 qf squared times u. And then if I add these two expressions and then add the contribution from E right, which would be the same from flipping all the spins, and then spin average, I end up with the following expression, d sigma d cosine theta for spin averaged electron quark scattering is 1 over 2s pi alpha squared. I multiply by 2, I divide by 4. 2 qf squared. Oh, sorry. Yeah, 2 qf squared s squared plus u squared over 2 squared. And so that is now our expression for electron quark scattering in the center of mass frame. And if these are all Lorentz invariants. So if I want to express this in another frame, I might look at the expression up here, for example, and write dt is equal to 2 e squared d cosine theta is equal to 1/2 s d cosine theta. So we can change the d cosine theta to a dt. And then what we finally end up with is this expression. OK. Very good. Okay, so now we've computed the cross-section for electron quark scattering. Now we have to compute the cross-section for electron proton scattering. Yes?
Why is it on this sigma dt?
Because this is identical to this formula, except that T is a Lorentz invariant.
Okay.
So this only is true in the center of mass frame, but this is true in any frame. Okay, so now let me make a very simple model of the proton. And then we'll use this formula to get the formula for electron quark scattering in that simple model. Sorry?
Equals 1/2 s d cos theta. Is there supposed to be an s?
Yes, there's supposed to be an s. Yes?
Is it, when you go to the amplitude of the sine over replacement?
Right.
Why don't you have a term coming from E minus R?
Oh, well there's, okay, so first of all I have to add in E minus R QR going to E minus R QR. But I claim that cross section is identical to this one.
Okay.
By the parity invariance of the electron.
Then where does the factor 4 become the factor 2?
Okay. So I double this to take into account this reaction.
Yes.
I double this to take into account ERQL. That should be mine. ERQL. So I double these reactions, add them up, and then I have to divide by 4.
Oh, because you're both averaging
because
over
I'm
the
both averaging over the E and the Q. And then this is actually correct. Okay, so now let's make a pretty simple model of the proton. The proton, we can either view this in the rest frame of the proton, where the electron comes in, the proton is at rest, and it gets smacked by the electron. Or we can view this with the proton going at high speed, like that. And different viewpoints are useful for different ideas. So what I'd like to do, when we actually do the experiment, the protons are at rest. The original experiments were done with a tank of liquid hydrogen, and you would shoot an electron beam into it. And so I'll do the kinematics in this frame. But for the purpose of the kind of thinking about it conceptually, it's easier to think about this frame, where the electron and the proton are in a colliding beam situation. Of course, that'll also help us when we talk about collider experiments like LHC, because we're interested in the proton going very fast and hitting another fast proton. So the model I'd like to take for the proton is that the proton is a big bag of quarks, antiquarks, and gluons. We take them out one at a time, so we'll scatter off one of these. The total proton momentum is p. The quark momentum will be little p, which is xp, where xi is some fraction between 0 and 1. And what I'll do is that I'll ascribe some probability, dxi f of xi. This will be the probability of finding a quark at momentum fraction xi in the proton. Now, this is a simple model, so I'm going to ignore any transverse motion of the quark with respect to the proton. That may or may not be a good approximation. We'll have to find out. But if the proton is loosely bound, then there won't be any large momentum transfer, so there's no way for the quark to get to large transverse momentum anyway. And then the last thing I'm going to do is that I'm going to ignore the mass of the quark and the mass of the proton. Presumably, this is justified because this theory will be good at sufficiently high energy. So this is my entire model of the proton. The other things come out, quarks and gluons. But we're only going to take the quarks one at a time. And when we take them one at a time, we will apply this answer. And then, actually, we can pretty much write down the answer right now. Yes?
Two questions. If you do this for the various different quarks that are coming out, do you require that the Xs between 0 and 1 all add up to 1?
So I will eventually. I will eventually. And that will be some kind of integral sum rule on the X.
And the F again represents?
The F represents the probability, the square of the wave function, the probability that the quark that I'm concerned with has a fraction C. So now we can just write the expression for the cross section d sigma is equal to the integral d xi f of xi. I need to sum over all the flavors of quark. And then I'll take that formula there, integral dt, d sigma dt. Well, that's the formula I wrote. Depends on the flavor of quark. Because the up quarks and down quarks have different charges, I want to take that into account. OK. Very good. So now we have, now we have a definite formula for electron-proton scattering. And now the only thing that remains is to beat that formula into a form in which we can compare to experiment and then see if it works. OK? Sorry? Oh, yeah, that was coming later, but maybe I should just say now. This model is called the Parton model. It was formalized by Feynman. So it has a good pedigree. These Fs are called the Parton distribution functions. And maybe I should just say that the proton can contain quarks, antiquarks, and gluons. And so we refer to all of the constituents of the proton collectively as partons. And partons have this xi. The xi is called longitudinal fraction. And it's a number between 0 and 1. OK? Very good. OK, so now we'd like to rewrite this expression as an expression that we can compare with experiment. And so the next question is, well, in an experiment, what do you actually measure? And what do we want to have the cross-section differential in? So the simplest way to do the experiment is to have some protons. So in fact, the original experiments were done with a liquid hydrogen target. And then you take the beam of electrons. Actually, these experiments were originally done at SLAC by a group, a collaboration of SLAC and MIT. And these were at 17 GeV. And you smack them into the liquid hydrogen target. And then the electron goes off, and you measure the electron momentum. And the proton is disrupted. It spills out some large number of pions. Let's, for the moment, ignore that and only concentrate on the kinematics of the electron. So the process would roughly be something like this. Lots of stuff coming out. And our model of it is that the electron hits an individual quark in the proton. So this is the process we're interested in, and this is our model. Let me label this momentum as q. You can see that q is equal to k minus k prime. A very important fact is that we know q by measuring things on the electron side completely independently of what's going on the hadron side. So let me formalize that a little. Let's write q squared is equal to minus q squared is equal to capital Q squared. The momentum transfer here is space-like. So minus q squared will be a positive quantity. Now let me write y is equal to 2p dot q over 2p dot k. So in the rest frame of the proton, this is the top will be the energy of the virtual photon here, and on the bottom we'll have the energy of the electron. So this is the momentum transferred to the proton from the electron divided by the total momentum of the electron. And y is a quantity between 0 and 1. And let me also define x as equal to q squared divided by 2p dot q. And it'll be clear in just a moment that x is a quantity between 0 and 1. And then you see that, and then this quantity here is s, the total center of mass energy squared of the reaction. So now you see that q squared is equal to xy times s. Good. Okay. Now what I'd like to do is to take this formula here and put it into the terms of these variables. So I hope you agree with me that q squared, y, and x are all measurable if I only measure the energy of the scattered, the momentum four vector of the scattered electron, and I totally ignore what's going on down here. Okay, well now there's a magic kinematic relation which is due to Feynman. And that is, let's look at our parton model over here, and in particular look at what's going on at this vertex. So let me draw that over here. In here comes the momentum p, which is equal to cp. The momentum q, which is known from the electron side, comes in the top. And out here, we have the momentum peak Cp plus Q. Now, this isn't elastic electron-proton scattering, but it is, in this simple approximation, elastic electron-quark scattering. So this guy is a quark, which should be on mass shell. So let's compute that relation. The mass of the quark squared, which, by the way, we're ignoring because we're at high energy, is equal to Cp plus Q squared, is equal to, well, we're ignoring the proton mass, too, so this is 0, plus 2Cp dot Q plus Q squared, which is equal to minus Q squared. So 0 is equal to 2 times C times P dot Q minus Q squared, which is to say C is equal to q squared over 2p dot q is equal to x. So this is pretty cool. If this model makes sense, then we can measure x from the electron momentum, and that picks out the longitudinal fraction of the quark which the electron scattered. Okay, well now we're doing great. Now let me just clean up this formula a little, and we will have a definite parton model formula for deep inelastic electron scattering. So now I want to write the integral d sigma. C I can replace by x, still summed over f. F sub f of x. Now, dt, t, if you look at this diagram here, t is the momentum transfer in this direction. So t is actually q squared. And q squared is xys, and we're already differential in x, so I can write this as dy times x times s. And then we're almost done. Oh, what are ST and U for this process? So maybe I should put little hats on these things. These are the ST and U for the parton level process. So we should work out what those are. Well, T is Q squared, which is X, Y, S. S hat is the center of mass energy squared of the quark electron process. So this is 2 little p dot k, which is equal to C or X times S. And U is minus S minus T. So that's equal to minus XS, T is minus Q squared, minus XYS. So this is XS times 1 minus 1. And then you see we have an XS squared here and an XS squared here. They cancel. And so we'll get 2 pi alpha squared over Q squared squared from the T. That cancels that. And what's left over is a 1 minus Y squared. And now I think we're done. So now let me just write this formula a little more cleanly. So d sigma dx dy, where x and y are two measurable properties of the final state, measurable only from the electron side, is equal to the sum over the quark flavor, the quark charge squared times x times the parton distribution function times 2 pi alpha squared over q squared times s from there times 1 plus 1 minus y squared, which is a factor that makes no reference to anything except some measurable kinematic quantities in the final state. Well, this is very cool. Complete factorization. This quantity here is called F2 of x and q squared. But what you see is that actually, in this model, it doesn't depend on q squared. It's simply a function of x. And that property has a name. It's called Bjerkane scaling. And actually, it was discovered by Bjerkane from some more highbrow theoretical considerations before the invention of the parton model. Okay, so now we've got a formula. So now how does it work? Well, now turn to the slides. So on slide 2, what you see is a photograph of the SLAC MIT deep inelastic scattering experiment. This is an old style particle physics experiment, but if you look at the slide, you will recognize all of the components. The target is actually off to the left. There's a little cryogenic tank with a liquid hydrogen target in it. The blue thing is a set of magnets that provide a magnetic spectrometer. Yeah, you have to be prepared. The blue thing is a set of magnets that provide a magnetic spectrometer for the outgoing electron. So they would measure the momentum of the outgoing electron. And then the big orange tank is an electromagnetic calorimeter. So that was used to figure out whether you had a pion or an electron. A charged pion would go right through it. An electron would make an electromagnetic shower in there that could be detected. And so the purpose of that was not so much to measure the electron energy. That would be given much more accurately by the magnets, as to just tell that the thing that was going through the magnets was an electron and not a pion. Okay, so now on the next slide, you have some of the data. Now, the other thing, maybe before you go off of page 2, is to notice that at the bottom, the thing is on railroad tracks. So you could actually turn it into any orientation with respect to the beam. And so to get to large Q squared, you want to go to large angle and also large energy of the electron. So what you see is there are three pictures which are the data for successively larger bins of Q squared. And you see that at low energy, very clearly there are resonances. And these are the nucleon resonances that we talked about before. But as soon as Q squared becomes large, the resonances all kind of blur together and get lost, and the distribution has a smooth curve. However, these smooth curves look completely different in every picture. So now what the experimenters did, because Bjerken was a friend of theirs, was to construct F2 is equal to d sigma dx dy divided by whatever is in that box there. Okay? And that is what is plotted in slide 4. And totally amazingly, it works. From every spectrometer setting, the data is only a function of x and is, at the level of this experiment, independent of Q squared. So this is very cool. This parton model had no right to be right. And the essence of the parton model is something that we've seen already in some previous lectures. The essence is that the proton structure has no large momentum transfers between the various quarks that would put them out at large transverse momentum or otherwise affect their behavior away from the free quark limit. So the quarks interact strongly to make a bound state, but at short distances, deep inside the bound state, they act like free quarks. And that's the same thing that we saw in E plus E minus, where at short distances, the quarks were produced like free quarks. And it's the same thing we saw in the annihilation physics of quarkonia. So it's something that needs a fundamental explanation. And on Monday, we will get there. So let me just make a couple more comments about this. First of all, you asked, I guess, do I have to insist that all the Cs add up to 1? And the answer is that the parton distribution functions have to obey some sum rules. Maybe I should say that this F should be summed over quarks and antiquarks. The formula for electron antiquark scattering is actually the same. The parton distributions obey some rules, for example, that the net number of up and down, up quarks and anti-up quarks has to be 2. The net number of down quarks and anti-down quarks has to be 1. And the total momentum, which is x times f of x, the total momentum fraction for all species, up plus down minus the anti-quarks, plus the gluons should be 1. So as far as we can tell, these sum rules are actually satisfied. And this one, from deep and elastic scattering, this part is about 50% of the total, which maybe isn't totally unreasonable, because the gluon should make up a large fraction of the total energy of the proton. On the next couple slides, there are just two more modern versions of this physics. So in the early 90s, there was an accelerator that was running, actually up until quite recently, there was an accelerator running in Hamburg, Germany, that did electron-proton colliding beam experiments at very high energy. The name of the accelerator is HERA. And so the last two slides give some pictures from HERA. So the next page is a modern version of the F2. And you notice that F2 has now been measured down to much lower values of x. And oddly, it keeps growing as the fraction decreases. So in the parton model, we can't think of the proton as just three quarks and gluons. At very small values of the momentum fraction, there are huge numbers of quarks and antiquarks. So the integral of fu of x is thought actually to diverge. But the difference goes to an integrable number. But at very small values of x, the so-called Feynman called them wee partons, there are huge numbers of quarks and antiquarks. And Feynman thought this was great. This was the basis of his theory of proton-proton scattering. The second comment is, I always kept not telling you what was going on the proton side. And this is a kind of a slack tradition, because the slack experiments could never figure out what was going on the proton side. It was too complicated. But when we get to the high energies of HIRA, it's very clear what's going on the proton side. And that's shown on the last slide. So this is a typical event at HIRA. What you see, the thing going up is the scattered electron, which is registering, as you see, in an electromagnetic calorimeter. The thing going down is obviously a jet of hadrons, just like the ones we saw in E plus E minus. And so the struck quark here, we now know, turns into a distinct jet when you observe it at high enough energies. So everything kind of fits together, except for this very mysterious thing about the strong interactions not being strong at short distances. And that'll be the subject of Monday's lecture. Yes?
When we talk about what we partons of having a huge number of quarks and antiquarks, how can we then say that we're talking about a proton being a three-quark composite particle and distinguish that from, like, say,
I guess the picture that's in my head is that when you have a proton at rest, or suffering only small momentum transfers, that it's basically three lumpy quarks. But when you hit the proton at very short distances, you resolve the structure of those quarks. And it turns out that every quark has a quark plus Q-Q-bar pairs inside it. And I will be very explicit about how this works in Wednesday's lecture. OK? OK, thank you.